Are you seeking thrilling tales of adventure and superheroics? Do you crave the weekly drama of teenage hijinks and high school angst? Then don't miss the next issue of These Protean City Comics.
This is volume 4.5, New Year's Eve bonus episode. On the cover, the Protean City cast is lying fast asleep on couches around a TV that shows Pitbull's Rockin' Eve having just counted down to midnight. Their series plotter, Brandon, is sticking his head into the panel, saying, "Congratulations, team." Team? The caption at the bottom promises, "Bonus content. GM talk. Nothing sinister." The first panel shows the inside of the Protean City public radio station. It's a small booth set up with all sorts of different records on the wall and just chaos and mess everywhere. There's a computer that has all sorts of different sound waves going across it and a microphone, and seated at the computer is the focus of this comic and the plotter of Protean City, Brandon Leon Gambetta. He is a short Latino guy. He's got kind of big blue glasses, and there's big barking sounds in the background coming from the very excited pup sitting at his seat. Pippin, the corgi puppy, both of them are labeled as such in a very classic comic book style. Pippin has not been in any previous comics, but of course Brandon has the editorial note suggesting that you check out Dr. Sybil, volumes 25 through 26, where he featured very heavily. The next panel shows him looking up directly towards the reader and giving a wave with a big grin on his face. "Oh, hey there, everybody. I'm Brandon. I'm so glad that you're able to drop in and read this comic. Quiet down, Pippin. It's okay. They're supposed to be here." Now, we had a basically voting set up last week that we said if we got to 25 votes in our Protean City romance, an editor's note right there, check out tinyurl.com/proteancityromance to vote. If we got to 25 votes by December 26th, we would put out an additional bonus episode instead of taking the week fully off. This had seemed like a really crazy idea, but it turns out that it was much easier to hit than we thought. As of this publication, we are at 63 votes already, and the race is really, really tight. So if you have a specific ship that you would really like to push and really like to see in February, you should let us know as soon as possible. Of course, we're going to be recording way before February, so better to get the vote in now. Brandon stands up and walks away from the computer, gives Pippin a little scratch on the head, and steps out to kind of like a little sitting area where it seems like he's going to be doing the majority of the rest of the issue. As he leaves, we can see that underneath his desk, there's a vague shape of somebody underneath it. They look vaguely cat-like. They've got kind of ears coming up, and just these slits of eyes and an enormous Cheshire Cat grin that quickly gives a wink and then fades away. We rejoin Brandon and he says, "I've got a whole bunch of different things to talk about within this bonus episode, and a lot of it is going to be questions that people have asked. So I don't want to spend too much time dilly-dallying and just kind of get right into it. If you're not interested in some of the process and ideas behind Protean City, then this might not be an episode for you. Sorry about that, but we'll rejoin you in the new year. There shouldn't be anything in it that will make you really behind in any sort of way." He pushes aside an action figure of Puck and picks up a couple of letters that have been placed near him and starts to kind of leaf through them, looking for something that is a good place to start. As he's rifling through them, we see that Pippin has caught the Puck action figure and is just gently chewing on his head, his little stumpy tail waggling back and forth happily. there also is a strange green slime that's coming in from underneath the door back to Protean City Public Radio recording suite. But I'm sure that's nothing that we need to worry about right now. Brandon clears his throat and looks at the first question. Our first question comes from Observer, who asks, what are your thoughts on custom and villain moves? What makes for a good villain move? Any suggestions for making players facing custom moves? Do you have any custom moves cooked up to drop in the show anytime soon? So, just basically all across the board, what are we looking at when we're looking at custom moves for Protean City? There haven't been a whole lot of them so far, and part of that has been me intentionally trying to teach the players the system. I am a huge fan of custom moves, and if you ever play Dungeon World with me, you will be using them every probably 5-10 minutes. I've used them probably too much there. What custom moves do is they fill in a lot of the spaces in the rules that exist. So we know that the majority of superhero action is handled by mask system. Brendan Conway and the Magpie Games crew did an amazing job of getting all of that into place. But sometimes you want something that works a little bit differently. Take, for example, the Hammer of Thor, Mjolnir. Needless to say, we would not be including that in our own production because our other giants of the comic book industry are a little bit more litigious than we are here at Protean City. But it doesn't really make sense to use the basic moves that we have at our disposal in terms of picking up that object and being able to use it. Theoretically, it could be an Unleash Your Powers. You are technically overcoming an obstacle, but it would make much more sense, for example, for that to be one with Savior. Now, you could just at the table say, we're making the roll with Savior, and that is honestly a fine custom move. It's a way of looking at the moves in a new way to make them work for what you're looking for. But it might be more fun to build something a little bit more complicated, more in line with the sorts of custom moves that we see from the playbooks and from the basic moves themselves. We had one custom move in our first volume that was related to the Steam Society. And when you mess with their creations, there was a chance of being able to shut them off and have them work in the way, or have them work in the way that you would like them to work. But there was also a chance of them releasing Steam or being purely decorative or things like that. Admittedly, that wasn't a very strong move, and I really wish that I'd put a little bit more thought towards that before putting it into the show. But, you know, these things happen. If you're making a custom move, you want every option to be something that is both interesting and pushes the story forward. So my option of the piece that you were able to work with was purely decorative, doesn't actually move the plot anywhere. I'm not happy with that move. It doesn't do what I want it to do. There are a couple of custom moves that are coming up that I unfortunately don't think I can talk about too much yet. As he's saying this, he moves the stack of papers, and you can see that there's a letter that is stamped with the appointed's symbol, which he hurriedly sticks underneath a table. We get another shot back of Pippin, who has finished devouring Puck's head and is just sort of looking up with a happy grin on his face. Making the move player facing is a really great way to make sure that the players are actually going to listen through the full move. And I would actually recommend having your custom moves written out ahead of time, maybe on a little index card that you hand to people. There's additionally going to be a custom move coming up in the Valentine's Day episode, which is going to involve a sliding stat. I can't tell you too much more else about that, but suffice to say that it's going to change the way that that episode plays through. My guess is it's actually going to be rolled quite a bit, which should be a lot of fun to see. Never feel afraid to use custom moves in your masks game. The rules that are set out are phenomenal ones, but you know what you need at the table. If you pick up the Halcyon City Herald collection, there's also a whole bunch of amazing moves in there. They're all really specific, but a lot of them can be used for what you're looking for in your game with a little bit of tweaking or changing some of the fluff surrounding it. Masks also has something called villain moves, villain moves are things that are actually more properly GM moves. They are the decisions that GMs make when a 7-9 or a 6- is rolled. In the Powered by the Apocalypse parlance, these are GM moves that can be soft moves or hard moves, and there's tons and tons of discussion to be had about that that I'm not going to get into right now. Essentially, what these moves are is they're a way to make your villains feel different from each other. So how do I make sure that Pterosaur and Dr. DeVillis don't feel like the same thing? The way I do that is I give them villain moves. Dr. DeVillis has moves that are related to really getting into a one-on-one thing with people, to pulling people into a hell dimension, or just getting right up in their face and being on top of them, and growing larger. Villain moves kick into place either on a miss, on a 7-9, or when they take a condition, when they are hurt by the players. Each time that the players successfully manage to go head-to-head or directly engage with their opponents, a move of some kind is being made. So if you have a character that tends to put people in danger, this is a great time to use them. Really, the core thing to remember is that this shouldn't be just a matter of threaten someone important. This should be telling exactly how it goes down and what it looks like when that happens. I think the move that honestly I'm happiest with in terms of the villains that I've shown up is Dr. DeVillis. Grabbing onto Puck and sending him into a hell dimension was cool and fun and led to some really interesting stuff coming up with Chance. That honestly is where a lot of my prep going into the game ends up being, is making sure that those villain moves feel different from each other and have the opportunity to tell a really interesting story. Observer also asked if I make use of arcs and hooks, which are two of the GM world and session building pieces of advice in the Masks book. I'll admit, I go a little bit off script on this one as well. I have an enormous document that is filled with countdown clocks and basically little descriptions of what happens at each time on the clock. The reason that I did that instead of the arcs and hooks setup from Masks is that, frankly, there's too many things going on currently. Masks is designed to kick it around 8 to 12 sessions from what it looks like, just looking at the advancement speed and advancement tracks. Most game tables will end at around that point. We're really trying not to end, so we need to handle things a little bit differently, which is going to involve switching out characters and doing things in different settings and different worlds and all those different things. But it also means that the basis of normal planning doesn't quite work. What I have in terms of my clocks, and this is a possible tiny spoiler, so skip forward 30 seconds, maybe probably closer to 3 minutes, is at least one countdown for each character. And what those countdowns do is they talk about the bigger story. So Alina Mars has a countdown clock that is labeled The Appointed. And at different points on that clock, it has advanced. If she does actions or makes a lot of misses that have to do with The Appointed, then that clock is going to advance faster, and we're going to get to the culmination of The Appointed plot much quicker. If we have a couple of weeks or a couple of months that we don't have Alina in it, then that countdown clock will kind of sit where it is, and then The Appointed will sort of fade into the background a little bit. But not dealing with a problem is enough to advance the clock. So looking at this document now, I have, we're going to give it a quick count. I have 18 currently running clocks. That doesn't involve any of the clocks that are going to be involved in later things. Essentially what this means is, using Fracture as an example, they were introduced at 0 o'clock on there, which states that Fracture appears when worlds are dying or when there are portals that are open of a sufficient size. Fracture had their interactions with Alina and with Sage, and then disappeared from the story. Because of what happened during the volume, Fracture's clock may or may not have gone forward. At a certain point, Fracture's clock getting to an area will, needless to say, open up big story things that are happening in relation to dimensional travel, and maybe not surprisingly, the end of dimensions. So when Fracture returns, all I have to do as a GM is go and look at this huge document and see what time it is on the clock, and then keep note of what's coming next. So if at 3 o'clock I have it down that X event happens, or that this power shows up, or that this character shows up, then that's all I need to make sure happens if we have a couple of misses. It's basically a little note to myself of, this is where things could go. A lot of this has to do with the fact that I'm not doing an enormous amount of pre-plotting this show. I really don't know what's going to happen with a lot of these different things, so the clocks are more or less what occurs in the world if the players don't interact with it. Needless to say, there's a real good chance the players will interact with it. I've already hinted in the past that there's a possibility that Fracture could become a playable character at some point, and really that's true of literally every character. We intend to do comics that aren't just these core players and really dive into other stories behind the scenes. I know that people have expressed some interest in seeing the miscreants in their own storyline, and I would really love to see that happen. That is something that would make me very happy. And I'd really love to play the Verminister of Fear again. He's a delight. To round us out and bring us to the end of the GM prep section of this cast, I just want to answer quickly a question that was posed to us by Aslanea, a dear friend of the show, that was basically asking how I do the beat mapping process that I've talked about. As I'm doing this show, I'm trying to prep in a way that is very different from how I normally would at the table. It doesn't really matter at the table if you have 3 climactic moments throughout. Ideally, you would. Ideally, you'd have lots of wonderful climactic moments, but you don't necessarily need to have a stopping point that you can say, hey, 45 minutes in, we need to have X happen. For podcasts, I feel like you kind of do. It doesn't really matter what events happen to me. What matters most is that we get a emotional line or a funny line or a big moment or something threatening right at the end of that episode so that you have a lot of reason to come on back to it. So here's how I set things up. For every idea that I have, I put it into a prep document. It starts out as the very quick and dirty idea. Using the holiday episode as an example, the players have to confront a major adult hero, and it's very difficult. That was pretty much my whole idea. I liked some thoughts on it. I wanted to see what the players do when they have to face an adult. From there, I also have other things that may be things like the miscreants. They are a group of characters that are gross and weird and don't fit into society. And even among Protean City's weird populace, they are freaks. Which was another basic miniature plot line that I'd put together and wasn't really sure where to get it put in yet. Once I have those pieces, I figure out who's going to be at the recording. If it's an event, then I might choose specific players for it, but often what I'm trying to do is just put together a team that hasn't been seen yet or is convenient for us to record with. We're all really busy people, so even just doing that can be a big piece. Once I have that list of players, that gives me a much better idea of what I'm going to be doing. Continuing with the holiday episode, I saw the miscreants, I saw that I was going to have the whole team, and I was like, oh man, let's put them up against a grown-up hero. From there, it was a matter of putting together story beats. I knew that the miscreants were going to come in at the very beginning of the episode, and that they were going to, in episode 1, be a physical threat of some kind. The funny thing here is that I don't actually necessarily know that there's going to be a physical superhero fight, or that they're even really going to be in contrast with each other. It's more that the miscreants are a obstacle standing in the way of the heroes. If they want to be taken seriously, they need to deal with the miscreants in some kind of way. that could also be stepping aside and letting the adult heroes handle things, and I made sure that there were adult heroes there to make that happen. So in my second step of production, I'm going, these are the miscreants, they're going to be here, and the first episode is going to end with some kind of a big moment related to the resolution. It might be somebody challenging the authority of the kids, it might be somebody just doing a big, scary attack. One of the ideas that I was floating was having the Burning Man explode and burn up the entire conference center. But that didn't end up happening because Puck pulled him through a portal. So the moment that I see Puck pulling through the portal, I'm going, okay, great, timing is right, there's our episode. And what I've actually started to do with the players is say, hey, we're coming towards the point of the episode where we want it to end on something big. I've got some ideas that I'm percolating right now as I'm sitting at the table, but if you get a really cool line, belt that line out, and that'll be our closer. So episode one begins with the miscreants, ends with some kind of big fight. Episode two begins with some vaguely holiday stuff, and I knew that I wanted it to end in a tense situation that they were up against an adult hero. For that adult hero, I chose Windshear because he's going to come up in a future episode, and I really wanted him to be a present threat when he shows up in that later episode. I don't want it to be, you know, he's scary. I want them to have gone face to face with him. So at this point, you might be noticing there's not a lot in there. I don't have a list of NPCs. I don't have really the setting of where things are going to be. I just know that they're going to, at the big climactic moment, be head-to-head with Windshear. Episode 3, I know, ends with wrap-up. The last episodes are in some ways the easiest to plot, because you just know that you're aiming towards a finish, and that finish might be something that's kind of nice and sitting around the fire, or it might be something really hard like the end of Volume 2. But hitting that ending makes kind of a lot more sense because the players know that they're angling for that as well. From there, I basically just start filling in the blanks. I need a place for every event to happen. I need more NPCs to litter the places, and I need my big list of names because I'm so bad at names. The miscreants were a group, and until about 3 days before, all I had on them was one of them has rats, question mark. And so really that's what I do with the mapping of the episodes. Currently there are two episodes that are recorded. One episode that is plotted to that third layer that I know which NPCs are going to be involved, what ideas are going to go through, and I have where the big beats are going to happen. Although I don't really know what those big beats are going to be yet, because the players really tend to bring those big beats. And I have two episodes that are plotted to kind of that second level that I know which NPCs are involved, but I don't have the story beats. And I have about 8 episodes that have that really bare minimum. This is a story I would like to tell. I would like to tell a story where they are in space, because Starjammers was very cool. And that's pretty much how the process goes in terms of making the episodes happen. That big far out idea has to happen probably 2 to 3 weeks before an episode is recorded. The second layer of it should definitely be by the week before. And all of those details need to have figured themselves out by ideally 24 hours before recording. But I've had one episode that I went in and it was figured out that day. So all of it is just kind of knowing what a story is shaped like and shaping the story into that. I don't know what's going to happen in a story, and I'm perfectly willing to change what those story beats are. I'm not willing to change where those story beats are because they need to end out the episodes and be these nice big moments. I'm always saying it's got to be punchy at the end, and that's what I'm super into. he puts that stack of GM questions down and stands up and walks over back towards the public radio station sitting area and gets himself down in front of the computer, sort of stretches, moves some things around. For a moment, he looks down at where there is definitely some weird green slime and looks at the schedule and sees that Sequential Encounters was recorded right before this and goes, ugh. They must have had like some kind of very sticky guest for the previous one. Pippin is looking suspiciously underneath the table where there is a definite shape of a person. The shape has changed somewhat. The eyes look more narrow and the mouth has changed to be a more serpentine sort of look. And there's a little tiny voice bubble at the very bottom of the page that reads, I've got an episode plotted too, but you haven't quite proved to me that you're ready to see it. We'll get there, though. Kisses. The voice sets Pippin barking, but clearly Brandon wasn't able to hear it. It's something outside of his physical ability, or it's psychically blocked from him or something like that. He opens up the email at this point, and there is another message in to answer. He opens it up and says cheerfully, this one is from Alice, who asked us if there are any specific inspirations I've used so far or in upcoming issues. This is definitely a funny question for me to answer, because I constantly find myself realizing that I am making the same characters that exist in other media. I've read a whole lot of comics in my day, and I kind of know that there's nothing that has been completely left open, but I try to at least not obviously steal things. There are certainly some characters that have taken some inspiration. It should be no surprise that Dr. DeVillis has some DNA from Hulk in him, and Pterosaur has been shown in like 100 different things. He's definitely a Pokemon plus the big fighting threat that you've already read about in other places. I think it's fair to even say that Nerds on a Roll deserves a tip of my hat from that one, because there's nothing like fighting a dinosaur at the Plaza Mall. In terms of the comics that most shape how I think about comics, the big ones to look at are the Marvel Ensemble groups. So things like the X-Men and the New Mutants especially are enormous, enormous, enormous things for me. They were comics that growing up I looked to and read and just felt a little bit more present because the characters don't fit in and the characters have things about them that other people don't have. To be hated and feared and also to be a superhero is to me a very important idea. And that's something that I really want to push in my things. There's having weird, funny groups of people is kind of my jam. In upcoming episodes, you're going to be seeing my version of Batman and my version of Widowmaker from Overwatch. Additionally, we have plans to do the Pet Avengers, but for Protean City. And that is shaping up to be quite an interesting little thing. But my inspirations are just all over the place. I also sometimes take some story ideas from non-comic book things. I've been watching the Leah Remini on Scientology TV show, and the appointed have maybe learned a trick or two from L. Ron Hubbard. I have another GMing question here. It comes from Miguel Aslaf. And he asks, what do you think of losing character advancements as a setback? This is something that I think is a very cool thing about Powered by the Apocalypse systems, and about masks specifically, is because you have villain moves that can be essentially anything, there's an enormous amount of flexibility. People look at the rules of masks and say, hey, this is a game that has a health system, but you can't die. It's impossible for players to die unless they decide to. And that, I think, is 50% right. According to the basic rules of the game, there isn't a core thing that says your character dies. However, following the narrative, there is. If Sokotoa were grabbed by Dr. DeVillis, he could face some really huge negative consequences. He doesn't have super strength. To be really frank, Puck could probably kill him by accident. And the threat of lasting consequences are something that I think is really important in a piece of media that is about teenagers that don't really have full control over themselves. We could see the death of superheroes. And if we had narration that demanded it, it could happen. No question. Slightly more on topic, there was that question of looking at advancements and taking them away. Remember, I'm a big X-Men fan, a big Marvel guy. There was a period of time where Storm had lost her powers entirely and was still in charge of the X-Men. Those, to me, are some of the best Storm moments. It shows her strength, it shows her internal power, it shows her intelligence. It shows so much about this character and why she's so important. She's not just lightning attacks. And I think that that's true for the players as well. If we hit a point that a character should lose their powers, then that can happen. If we hit the point that a player can lose an advancement, that's okay. We're playing a long campaign. I think part of that has to do with looking at the golden box in role-playing games. In some games, if it's on your sheet, it can't be touched, and GMs that touch it are doing something that's bad. So lots of players really hate when D&D GMs will put rust monsters in their way or will do level drain or stuff like that, because it's so much worse to lose your things than to have your character die. And I don't think that that's true in a genre that things can come back. If you lose your powers, they can come back so much better, or you can get new powers, or there's new possibilities. And advancements, I think, are just the same. The important thing that I think you should do is if you take a player's advancement, you should also erase the check mark next to that advancement. Basically, you don't want to make it so that they've lost something and they can't get something back in the future, because that could be really obnoxious. Another thing that Masks has that really helps with this is the moment of truth. All playbooks get access to a moment of truth twice during that playbook's lifespan. Moments of truth tend to be these big pivotal sections of the characters' lives that they aren't awkward teenagers awkwardly trying to fight something that's much bigger than them. It's them coming into their own power and being what it is they need to be, having what it takes, and then afterwards dealing with that fallout. And those are some really good places that you could give a player their advancement back if you feel that they've re-earned it. Thinking about Alina, who is the protege, if the asset died, she would lose access to quite a few things on her playbook. And that's big and scary, but that's also a really good story moment. So I always follow the narrative on these things. Additionally, that means that if the narrative demands that somebody get something, they might suddenly have access to a move. If a character got a spaceship, well, that's the Kirby Craft move from The Outsider. And it's okay to give the player that, because that's what they have now, and it makes sense. And knowing that it could be taken away at any moment just makes them maybe treasure it a little bit more, and maybe makes them a little more hesitant to drive it into a sun. We have another question from Alice, and that question is, what's the most surprising thing a player has done so far, and what's the most surprising thing a player other than James has done so far? James surprises me really often in this. Puck is unpredictable, and I'm really bad at keeping his memory manipulation power in my head. For some reason, I always forget about it and just don't expect him to be using it. I think the time that I was really the most surprised by him was when they were facing Pterosaur, and instead of going up and being the brawler that could stand toe-to-toe with Pterosaur, he grabbed onto a dinosaur's head and took his memories. It hadn't even really occurred to me whether that's something that he'd be able to do. Pterosaur is kind of a force of nature, but then he made the Unleash Your Powers roll, and of course it worked. And then that moment of surprise was replaced by the surprise of him sticking those memories into Striped Eagle's head, which had me literally just looking at him across the table with my mouth open for a bit. In terms of non-James moments, there have been so many just wonderful, great ones. I think the most surprising non-James one was Rob taking over Centurion's suit and just pushing through with those powers. It really didn't occur to me at all that he would go after the technology that somebody else was already using, but it works so well for Frequency, and it was just delightful. Honestly, I feel so blessed to have the opportunity to work with this entire cast and all of these characters in it. Brandon gets up from the computer and kind of shuts things down, and he turns and is walking over to a bookshelf that is set up with all sorts of different Protean City merchandise behind him, tons of characters, some of them recognizable, some of them not yet shown in the podcast, but he's just got a huge grin on his face. With our first year done, admittedly only with about 3 months of content, we're excited with where we are. We think that we've made some pretty good stories and some characters that people seem to be liking, and we want to have more. One of the big things that has been a driving force of Protean City, and we want to make really explicit now, is that we are a publishing company that is focused on diversity and inclusion. One of the reasons that I wanted to do a superhero comic was because I don't see a whole lot of Latino superheroes that aren't reboots of previously existing superheroes. So as we are coming into the new year, if you read our comic and you don't see yourself in our comic, let us know. We have so much more left to do. There are so many who haven't been able to see a media superhero that is them, and that's really important to us. Needless to say, we don't want to get into some form of tokenism where we pat ourselves on the back for having one of everybody. We want to make a city that feels alive and feels like it really is like our world and has the breadth of people that we interact with and that we are. So thank you for pushing us along in that journey and making sure that we are on the ball with it. We've gotten messages from people that have thanked us for things and have suggested things, and both of those make such a huge difference. We can't even really express it fully. Our listeners really help us to make this comic in a very concrete, real way. And there are multiple things going on right now that can help you to change the Protean City world. One of those is going to tinyurl.com/proteancityromance to vote and see who you would like to see in the February Valentine's Day special. Feel free to vote for more than one ship, but please don't vote for the same ship more than once. We want to try to keep things as fair as we possibly can. It lists more or less all of the teenage characters that you've seen so far. There is an additional little project going on that I can't talk too much about because the editors haven't told me a whole lot about it. From behind his speech bubble, you can see is peeking a odd little creature. It looks vaguely serpentine still, and it is probably what was underneath the desk previously, because it has the same color scheme, but it has just a wide sneer on its face, and it's giving a little wink. At this point, Brandon turns and goes back to the desk, picks up his coffee cup, and raises up to the readers and says, "Thank you for all of your patience with us and for being a part of our process. It's been so incredible, and I'm looking forward so much to continuing working with all of you. All right, say bye, Pip." And he looks over at Pippin, who is wearing a bright red cape, and Brandon's eyes go kind of wide, and he quickly grabs a pillow and tosses it to try to block the view of Pippin and says, "No, hold on, those are spoilers, don't show them that." And we get a panel that shows him chasing Pippin out into the rest of the room. The next panel is darker. It's in the Protean City Public Radio building, in that same lab that we kind of started things out with. And sneaking out from behind a stack of shelves, clearly having been squished behind to a point that he'd have to be almost two-dimensional, is a well-dressed gentleman in pale gray clothing. His skin is mottled and looks kind of like that of a chameleon. And it even shows, like, it has got some weird coloration around the edges. And he glances back towards where Brandon has disappeared and says, "Well, listen, it's been a fun time. I've been enjoying it. But I've been kind of kept on the sidelines. So I think it's time that we ignore the editorial mandates and start handling things our way. Come find me. And you and I will build a better future for Protean City and for everybody. I'll be hiding out at the Protean City public radio station. Just don't let the capes know. They get so uppity about these things. Send me a tweet and we'll talk. All right? This is gonna be a good year. I feel like 2018 is really gonna turn things around for us." At that point, he turns around and starts walking away. And as he does, he just starts to slip down into smaller forms. First, a kind of like hunched bear, and then moving further, a opossum, and just like gives a look over his shoulder and a big toothy grin before disappearing down into the cracks in the floor by the wall. The final panel shows sickened, dripping laughter coming forth from that same little crack. And in the background, we can see Pippin flying through the air with Brandon holding steadfastly onto his little stumpy legs, giving a wave towards the readers as our first bonus episode comes to a close.
Protean City Comics is a production of the Stop, Hack, and Roll podcast network. It is produced and edited by James Malloy. This issue was emceed by Brandon Leongambetta, who can be found on Twitter at Dr. Captain Cobalt. The introduction was voiced by Peter DeGilio. All music was composed by Jim Malloy. Masks, A New Generation, is a game by Brendan Conway and published by Magpie Games. This podcast is created thanks to the financial support of backers at patreon.com/stophackandroll. Join us at our Discord at discord.stophackandroll.com or follow us on Twitter at Protean City. Subscribe to Protean City Comics on iTunes or wherever podcasts are found. Join us next Wednesday to find out what thrilling adventures lie ahead.